Cabernet tends to be the sort of Errol Flynn of the grape varieties.
The most expensive beer in history.
People will turn around to me and say, oh, I'm just making gin while I wait for my whiskey to get ready.
Because wine is an adventure.
Conventional winemakers who just condemn all natural wine as faulty.
The prestigious title of Sake Samurai.
Looking at whiskey in more of an artful culinary way.
They kind of look at it as a novelty more than anything. The guy from the rock bands is making wine.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine, and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Tom Acatelli is one of America's leading beer writers, and he's with us this episode to tell you all about his latest book. It's called Pilsner, How the Beer of Kings Changed the World. And it's a character-driven narrative that shows how this one beer style influenced everything from modern-day advertising and marketing to the craft beer movement of recent decades. The book shatters myths about the birth of Pilsner, demonstrating that it's actually largely a German invention rather than a Czech one. Pilsner is something of a prequel to Tom's brilliant history of the American craft beer movement, the audacity of hops. So I took this opportunity to ask Tom about the current outlook for this industry sector in America, where conditions have gotten very difficult for the more than 8,000 craft breweries that were operational when the pandemic hit in 2020. What I love about Australian craft spirits is that our distillers are truly free to experiment. We aren't governed by rules and traditions. That's why the flavour and character of Australian spirits is so unique. But it takes distilling prowess and another critical ingredient to bring these products to market, and that ingredient is Bintani. Bintani supplies distillers with malts of all colours, flavours and aromas. They have a leading range of yeast and other ingredients and the professional expertise to help distillers create the spirits of their dreams. Make Bintani your partner in taste and quality. Tom Acatelli, thanks so much for joining us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, this book, Pilsner, it looks like an incredible amount of work has gone into it. What was the inspiration for exploring this one style in so much detail?
Thanks. Well, my last beer book, which came out in 2013, and there was a second edition in 2017, was The Audacity of Hops, The History of America's Craft Beer Revolution. And it was exactly like the title implies. It was a history of craft beer in the U.S., and in much of the world, starting in the early 1960s. And then I took a detour into wine and whiskey writing and wanted to come back to beer and wanted to come up with an idea that would be kind of a prequel to The Audacity of Hops. And rather than try to tackle all of beer history, because as you know, James, it's quite a history. It goes back thousands of years. So rather than do that, I picked Pilsner because so much of what we know about beer today and consumer tastes and brewery production and criticism is a reaction to the rise of Pilsner before the 1960s. And so I settled on Pilsner, honed in on it as a way to kind of write a prequel to craft beer.
What sort of research was involved? Because you're really getting into a lot of detail into the history of the style in Europe.
Yes. Well, one of the great things about researching Pilsner, which, you know, basically dates from the early 1840s, in Central Europe, Central Eastern Europe, you know, all the way through today, is that some of the breweries that were key and some of the people kept very detailed information, okay? Not just brewing records and recipe records and whatnot, but, you know, production, the correspondence of the major players is available. So it was just a great thing and very helpful to my research to be able to sort of stand on this breadth of work that was already there to be tapped, if that makes sense. You know, when I did Audacity of Hops, I often was the first person mining the information. And so I'd have to go seek out the people who had experienced it and get their memorabilia or their own notes from the time. But in Pilsner's case, a lot of it was there for me to mine. And then there was also traveling, probably my two favorite, or at least illuminating visits. One was the Spaten Brewery in Munich. And that, you know, just sort of opened my eyes to the role that Germans and Bavarians in particular played in the rise of Pilsner and in so much of our beer culture today in Australia and in the US. And the second great visit was to the Coors Brewery in Colorado Rocky Mountains in the U.S. And it's supposedly, I was never able to confirm this, but supposedly the single biggest brewery in the world. And it's massive. And I visited, now here's the funny, this is why it was so illuminating and you know, sort of helpful for my book, was that I was out in Denver, in Colorado, for the Great American Beer Festival. And so the last Saturday that I was there for the Great American Beer Festival, I went to that. I went to the GABF for a bit. And then I went to the Coors Brewery, which is about 40 minutes away. So I was around all this sort of, you know, esoteric, funky beer, you know, sours, Belgian pale ales, what have you. And then the next, you know, 45 minutes later, I'm getting a tour of it was a Saturday. So it was an almost entirely empty, massive, several football fields sized brewery, you know, in the middle of these super quiet mountains. And I realized craft beer is so ascendant and we all love it and it's everywhere, but it just production wise and consumption wise, you know, the great Pilsner producers like Coors are so far out ahead in terms of, you know, production and volume. And so that was sort of an eye opener for me.
And I suppose the whole narrative that has inspired the craft movement is about these factories, like you're just describing, that don't have much soul to them and don't have the same history and heritage to them that craft brewers, at least in the beginning, reprised. It seems like through this book, you've really explored the fact that there is a really interesting heritage behind these fizzy light lagers that everyone drinks today.
Right. And remember, I mean, this was the eye-opener for me too, was that, you know, we kind of take for granted the timeline, or we think we sort of live at the end of history when it comes to beer and brewing. But these guys, especially in the 1860s and 1870s in the upper Midwest of the U.S., you know, think Miller, think Anheuser-Busch, Pabst, or in Heineken in Northern Europe, they saw themselves as innovators and cutting edge. And they were trying to sort of rescue beer from markets that were awash in hard liquor. You know, in Heineken's case was, you know, gin. And the U.S. was whiskey country for decades after the American Revolution was whiskey. You know, George Washington had probably the biggest whiskey distillery in North America for a time. So they saw themselves as innovators. And they were not only reacting against these spirits, they were reacting against the dominance of English-style ales, particularly pale ale and porter. And so they were like, we're making a hot, fresh, cutting-edge new beer style, Pilsner, and beers based on Pilsner, you know, light, the sort of lighter-colored, lighter-tasting lagers. So they saw themselves as kind of the craft brewers of that era. But the problem, not necessarily the problem, but the reality of it is that they became so big so quickly, and Pilsner swept everything before it, you know, almost wiped IPA off the face of the earth, pushed back porter, certainly pushed back every sort of idiosyncratic style you can name that's now popular today, such as sour beers, Roche beer, styles like that, and just became so dominant by the mid-20th century that Pilsner became synonymous with beer.
Yeah, and I mean, even now, if you were to ask most people, mainstream consumers, not craft beer enthusiasts, to describe what a beer looks like, they would probably tell you about something that was straw to golden in colour, fairly clear, with a really nice, beautiful, foamy head. But you make the point in the book that beer looked nothing like that before the arrival of Pilsner.
It was trending toward that, but it was not inevitable. So, you know, as many of your listeners probably know, you know, beer dates back millennia, and it was overwhelmingly for thousands of years taken for granted that it would be dark, often thick. You know, there might be chunks of stuff floating in it. You know, it was not known for its sort of crisp effervescence or for its clarity. But there were already, beginning with pale ales in the UK and Dunkels in what became Southern Germany, you know, there was the emergence. By the time Pilsner was born in the early 1840s and what became the Czech Republic, there were lighter colored, lighter tasting beers, but nothing like was tapped in 1842 in Pilsen. So, you know, you're right. I mean, it's just, it was a real revelation for people to know that beer could have that kind of clarity. And it also fit in, you know, this was another big thing in the book, Pilsner. It was, and I really loved writing about this because I like the convergence of business history with social history. There were all sorts of things going on at the time that made consumers want the sort of sleek new thing, which Pilsner just looked like, because it was, you know, it was golden colored, it was bubbly like champagne, and it didn't fill you up like the heavier English style ales. And so that sort of aided its rise. I say in the book, you know, it picked the best time to be born, and then it picked the best time to leave home.
So tell us about the first ever Pilsner. How did that come about?
Well, the burghers, the sort of local aristocrats in this mid-sized city in the Austrian Empire called Pilsen, which is just a, you know, I know we're sort of in all dealing with COVID and the disruption of COVID, but it's a gorgeous, Pilsen is a gorgeous place to visit even today. And it's very manageable. You can fly into, you know, Prague and get there in a couple of hours. It's a fantastic little city. But the aristocrats there who had the right to brew beer, basically brew and sell it, were facing competition from better made beers just over the border in Bavaria. And they didn't like these Germans stealing their market share. So basically the Czechs got together and said, look, we're going to start our own brewery. And what we're going to do is we're going to import Bavarian talent, knowledge, material, and ideas, and use it in our brewery in Pilsen. And they imported, they imported all of that, including a brewmaster named Josef Grohl, who it's not clear whether he intended to do it or not, but put together this remarkably, you know, golden, effervescent, lighter tasting, not as alcoholic lager. And they tapped in late 1842, and kind of, you know, the rest is beer history. It spread very quickly, first in the empire there, then to different parts of Germany, you know, what became Germany. Then, you know, there's kind of the rest of Europe, wherever beer was appreciated, except maybe the British Isles. They held out for a long time, as you know. And then, you know, the business history intersects with the social history. There was a massive massive tumult in Europe in the 1840s, so just after Pilsner was born. And there's revolutions and counter-revolutions. And long story short, about a million Germans and Czechs decamp for the United States. And they settle in cities in the upper Midwest like St. Louis, Chicago, Milwaukee. And of course, they bring beer and brewing culture with them. And, you know, Pilsner was the ascendant style at that time. And that's kind of where you get the big players, at least in the U.S. and eventually globally.
You make the case in the book that Pilsner was largely a German invention rather than a Czech one, which must be a controversial point for some readers.
Yeah, no, I've heard some feedback on it. But I must say the brewery in Pilsner was actually quite helpful. And they shared an unpublished history that they have, an in-house history of the brewery. And it was quite good and quite compelling. But yeah, I just see it as it's a distinctly German thing. It really is. And I mean, now the original Pilsner, I think, others think that it could not have happened anywhere else. You know, the water played a role, the climate played a role. But it was definitely his German know-how, it was German material, it was German talent. And, you know, it wasn't an accident. The burghers of Pilsen, the aristocrats who controlled the brewing rights, they set out to usurp these Bavarians who were stealing all their sales. So they, you know, it wasn't an accident that they ended up making, you know, German-influenced beer.
So essentially all the modern lagers that people have been drinking, you know, in more recent times, they can all be traced back to 1842.
Yes, most certainly, yes. And that's one of the things that really struck me too, was there was kind of this, you know, there's this root and then all the branches that sprang from it. But I think it's interesting to sort of juxtapose that against craft beer, which, you know, there you can trace craft beer's evolution from a handful of ideas and a handful of breweries. but it's, it went in all sorts of style directions pretty quickly. Whereas, you know, Pilsner and then the breweries that got behind that, you know, they marched behind one approach all over the world, and they prided themselves on replicating it, you know, being able to do it, whether it was in Australia, whether it was in the United States, whether it was in South Africa, whether it was in Japan. And I think that's one of the remarkable things. I mean, you'll hear even from craft brewers, you know, and real, you know, craft beer snobs who say, you know, I can't stand this beer. Oh, it's just terrible. It's so watery. All the macro brews, I hate them. But they will begrudgingly say, you know, it's an engineering triumph. And Pilsner really does represent that. And it came along in a period in history, especially in the U.S. and Europe, where that sort of technical know-how and industrial reproduction capability was appreciated. And I think that really helped its rise. You know, the great German-American brewers like Adolphus Busch and Frederick Miller or Frederick Pabst played a role not only in the mass production of beer, but in influencing, you know, industrial production and the evolution of it in general all over the world.
What were some of the other factors that really supported the rise of Pilsner, some other, you know, market conditions and changes that were happening at the time?
Sure. Pasteurization was a big thing. You know, the sort of being able to rid beer of infection at a time when, and this is another thing that aided its rise, when more and more beer was being produced in bottles and being poured into glass, right? So you wanted a clean looking, nicely presented beer. And Pilsner lent itself to that because it looked fantastic. It looked like gold and poured in a glass or shipped in a bottle. And it's actually very interesting. Anheuser-Busch in the 1890s was just sort of producing more bottled product than any company in the world. It was, of course, you know, bottled beer. But they called themselves, you know, the king of bottled beer. You know, of course, like 70 years later, they dropped bottle and just called themselves king of beers, and which I think they still do. So there was that. There was the mass glass production, pasteurization, you know, artificial refrigeration, vertical integration, which Anheuser-Busch in particular was a big pioneer in, basically of just owning every step of production and sales. So you have that as well. And I think, you know, politically, too, you know, the German Americans in the U.S., you know, gained a lot of prominence and power and were able to keep for decades at least, you know, eventually it succumbed, but to keep, you know, prohibitionists at bay. So that helped the rise, you know, that spread it pretty far and wide. I also think, you know, things we kind of take for granted when we look at food and drink history, but I think play a more prominent role and deserve more attention, you know, developments like the telegraph, the telephone, the steamship, anything that aids the sharing of information and of ideas, I think helps along, you know, a new innovation. And I can actually, you know, I prove that in the book because some of these world fairs were being held in places like Paris and Vienna. You know, brewers displayed at these world fairs, which in an era before, you know, mass marketing and commercialization, and never mind TV and radio, were showcases for new products. And in some cases, especially in Vienna, at the Vienna World's Fair, there was, you know, Pilsner was kind of a sensation as far as the food and drink exhibits went. And people took that, you know, reality back with them to places like St. Louis and were like, oh, we got to copy this.
In America, how did we get from the Pilsners that were very much modeled on the German style to the modern light lagers? What was the sort of evolution that happened there and why did it happen?
That's an excellent question. I think the evolution was kind of a foot race, you know, kind of a land rush to get the market share. So if you wanted to be a successful brewer, pretty much anywhere that, you know, beer was drunk in say by the 19-teens, the 1920s, you want to produce a lighter colored, crisper lager. You don't want to produce a heavier ale. Those have fallen out of favor. And you don't want to produce an ale that's bitter. You want lager. You want lager, number one. You want it lighter colored. You want it lighter tasting. You want to be able to replicate it anywhere you go, right? So, you know, because that was a big thing in brewing too. And we're seeing it again today. You know, the big get bigger. And a lot of the smaller players sort of sort of fall away. So I think, you know, we get to where we are by the end of the 20th century, at least when it comes to Pilsner, because that's where the market was. Consumers went there. We don't like to talk about that sometimes in craft beer circles, but people preferred it. They wanted those type, that kind of beer. They didn't want the IPA. They didn't want the porter. Pilsner won because that's what consumers wanted. You know, the big brewers would, after a while, especially in the late 20th century, become just phenomenal expert marketers. And, you know, their approaches to advertising seeped into everything from sports to television. But they were really following where the market was taking them. It's what people wanted to drink. That's why, I mean, I'm not as familiar with the Australian scene as I should be, but in the U.S., Pilsner still dominates sales. I mean, the craft beer has been around here, and it's for 50 some years now. Yeah, 50, 55 years. And it's been a major presence for 2025, and it still accounts nationally for about 15% of the market. And what's the rest? The rest is Budweiser. The rest is Miller Lite. The rest is Heineken. The rest is Foster's.
Have you listened to season 7 of the Drinks Adventures podcast?
The mixer category has become dominated by large conglomerate brands who ultimately ended up focusing more on manufacturing efficiency than quality or flavour.
Fever Tree's Tim Warrilow gives you the inside story of how his company changed mixers forever.
My research showed that the highest quality quinine was unfortunately just about the most remote and lawless place, which was in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo.
Fever Tree, the mixer of choice in the world's top bars and restaurants, and a proud supporter of the Drinks Adventures podcast. Find their new soda collection out now.
We've developed this Mexican lime and yuzu soda to go with vodka, and this Italian blood orange soda to suit this spritz move movement that is growing around the world.
Now, the first Australian lager, to my knowledge, was Excelsior brand lager, which was produced by the Coen brothers in Bendigo, Victoria in 1882, and then Foster's Lager came very soon after that. Are you able to fill in any of the detail of what happened in those 40 years between Pilsner in the Czech Republic and lager arriving in Australia?
Right, well, what happened was, you know, emigration and immigration and people basically, wherever people with a taste for beer, and inevitably it was people of, you know, Germanic descent, or taste for lager. I should stop saying a taste for beer because, as you know, the very distinct universe spheres, and they often didn't intersect until fairly recently. But anywhere that these folks went, they tended to bring the taste for and the market for, of course, for these lighter colored lagers. And that's what happened in Australia. That's what happened in the US. And so what happens in that 40-year interval, when these lighter lagers make it from, you know, Central Europe, where the Central and Eastern Europe were taking off and where they were basically invented, and all the way to Australia, is because people who wanted them and knew about them could, you know, took the knowledge and the demand with them. I think one of the interesting things about, you know, Foster's in Australia, if I remember correctly, the Foster brothers were actually American, and they left New York to go to Australia and then launched, I believe, the brewery in Melbourne, and had a German brewmaster. Again, like where the Germans or where the German know-how went, so went this type of beer. But, you know, also credit the fact that people wanted it. For whatever reason, it just, and I go into several reasons in the book, but for whatever reason in different markets, it just took off. And it's really phenomenal. I mean, it's not, you know, beer is not, it's an acquired taste in most cases. So the success of Pilsner and the success of these lighter, crisper lagers is really one of the big food and drink stories, I think, in the last several hundred years.
Absolutely. Now, you sort of touched on this earlier, but there are some definite parallels between the rise of Pilsner and the craft beer movement that you explored in your other book, The Audacity of Hops.
Definitely. I mean, I don't think there would be a craft beer movement, revolution, industry without the rise of Pilsner and the fact that so much Pilsner became homogenous and mass-produced and, you know, oftentimes indistinguishable one brand from the other. In the Audacity of Hops, I often set up what I termed Big Beer as the villain. You know, as you know, Budweiser's and the Miller Lights. They took this, you know, beautiful, wonderful thing called beer, and kind of, you know, ruined it for us. And that is true to a degree, but it's a much more nuanced tale because, as I said, the guys who did the Pilsner they were innovators in their own right and were responding to market demand. They weren't tricksters trying to get one over on the consumer. So the simple meteoric rise of Pilsner over those decades and the fact that it spread so far to every corner of the beer drinking world relatively fast is what caused this massive counter reaction that we're still seeing today. You know, people wanted to rescue these styles that Pilsner had basically relegated to the fringes of the beer world.
What about back in, you know, Germany and Czech Republic? How similar are the Pilsners of today to those original Pilsners back then?
That is an excellent question, and there's a lot of debate on that. I can't answer definitively whether they would take. They all descriptions suggest, and including from the, you know, there was a British gentleman who basically scouted the 1873 Vienna World's Fair, where Pilsner made a big splash. And he basically describes it in terms that we would understand today. You know, it was golden colored. It was, you know, the clarity was remarkable. It had a light, effervescent, bubbly taste on the tongue. So I think, you know, what it was then, 170 years ago, is very, very similar to what it is now. But there's debate, you know, whether it's exactly the same. I mean, you know, the brewery in Pilsen will claim that they make it the same way. And that's just, I just don't necessarily buy that because of the production numbers involved. But Pilsner Urquell is made in that one spot, which I think is remarkable.
They've got some pretty rustic kind of equipment there, though, they do. Don't they, that people sort of talk about when they go?
And they, if you do the tour there, there's, I'm not sure how to describe it, but they have it from vats, you know, and it's sort of, it's only sold in Pilsen and a couple, at the brewery itself and a couple of establishments. There was actually one right across the street from my hotel, which I thought was fantastic. I had beer for breakfast, and I don't do that very often. It's like unpasteurized. It was just fresh out of the vat. I can't even describe the taste, like a super bready taste, but effervescent as well, you know, like crisp, like prickly. Like, it was fantastic. So I think, you know, if you get it in that sense, in that environment, you might get close to the original. But then, of course, also with a lot of the bigger producers, by the post-World War II era, they're scaling up enormously, and they're just hoovering up all their competition. They're getting bigger and bigger. And so to produce it, they have to introduce more and more adjuncts and, you know, sort of preservatives. And while I think that the Pilsners of, say, the late 19th century probably looked and felt the way they do now, the taste was probably lighter and fresher, you know, and crisper than, I don't know about you or your listeners, but I often find, you know, Miller beers or Budweiser kind of almost alkaline, like heavy. I know that sounds strange because I've been describing them as light, but I actually think, you know, like a well-prepared craft Pilsner is light, but the macro producers are kind of heavier on the tongue or on the palate.
Let's talk about craft Pilsner for a minute. What are you seeing over in the US? There's been a lot of talk about how Pilsner is having a bit of a moment in the States at the moment.
Sure, you're right. No, you're right. You know, in the US, we were kind of reaching this sort of peak of bitterness, and you know, IPAs were getting hoppier and hoppier and hoppier, and you know, I think the pinnacle came in the last 10 years with the birth of the New England IPA style. And I'm actually calling in from New England in the U.S. And these sort of the hazy, super bitter, super kind of heavy IPAs, and that was, you know, the definitional craft beer in the U.S. I can tell you that, you know, when I was doing media interviews for the Audacity of Hops 8 years ago, that's what everybody wanted to know about. Oh, you know, they would say something like, oh, like Sam Adams. I say, yes, but I hear so much about these really bitter, super strong, you know, IPAs, explain, talk about India Pale Ale. And I used to talk about India Pale Ale, but now, you know, there's sort of a reaction within a reaction. So IPA, the rise of IPA is a reaction to macro-produced pilsners, and now craft pilsners are a reaction to the rise of these super bitter IPAs. And so I, you know, it's kind of a interesting full circle here as far as craft goes. And, you know, it's remarkable. Some of these craft pilsners are really remarkably made. They're super tasty. And, you know, I would just add, James, brewers regard pilsner and lighter lagers in general as, you know, much more difficult and requiring more skill and skillfulness to make than some of these heavier ales. Because as Garrett Oliver, he's the longtime brewmaster at Brooklyn Brewery in New York, as he so excellently put it, you know, they call it naked beer because there's nowhere for imperfections to hide. You know, you pour it in the glass, you see it in the bottle, you're going to see any lack of clarity. So that's another aspect. I think, you know, they're kind of, especially on a smaller scale, when you don't have the access to some of the top-notch equipment, it's kind of a miracle of production.
Craft Pilsner is probably also a reaction to hazy IPA. You know, some of the badly made hazy beers we're seeing around these days, they can have chunks in them as well. And you know, just why have we gone back to that?
I don't know if it's the case in Australia, but some New England IPA producers suggest you drink it from the can. Supposedly for a better appreciation of the aroma, but I'm not wondering if in some cases it's so you don't pour it. I'm not saying they're unappetizing or not made well, but I think in some cases, I think it's so people don't see, you know, this dense sort of cloudy beer that they might not then want to repeat drinking. So
now you mentioned that Audacity got a second edition, which is, I've actually read the second edition and I want to compliment you on it. It's a really entertaining exploration of the history of craft beer in America. Is there going to be another edition? Because it occurs to me with recent events that the craft beer market over there could look very different in a year or two to what it did when you did your last edition.
Yes, I thank you very much. And I am looking into doing another edition, hopefully in time for the anniversary of the Great American Beer Festival in 2022, next year. I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's kind of remarkable. There's two prongs to the change. One, on the consumer side, there's more variety than ever. There's more, you know, styles that weren't even conceived of, have been born, risen, and had their day, like New England IPAs, or still having their day. And then on the business side, there was a remarkable blossoming of just the number of breweries, not only in number, but sheer volume, but also in where they were. For a long time, the craft beer scene here was concentrated in California, Oregon, Washington State, Colorado, and let's say the Northeast. But now it's everywhere. I mean, every town, mid-sized city, you'll be driving along and, you know, you'll see signs for, you'll be driving along in the country and you'll see signs for a, you know, craft brewery, which is fantastic. But at the same time, you know, the number got so big that it's starting to massively and quickly retract. And, you know, the bigger players, they started buying up and buying up the smaller players and co-opting their, you know, nomenclature and their ideas in the 90s, but it really accelerated in the last 10 years. And then I would just add that COVID is not helping the situation because a lot of smaller players, especially, you know, they had to shut down their tasting rooms where they move a huge volume of beer. And a lot of them, unfortunately, are probably not going to survive the winter here, certainly not the spring. So, you know, while it's a wonderful time to be a craft beer drinker in the U.S., it's, you know, a troublesome time to be actually in the business.
Yeah, well, last I checked, you know, there were in excess of 7,000 craft breweries over there. You were saying that that number has definitely peaked and is now in decline.
Yes, I would not be surprised. Well, I do know that several hundred have already closed. Just where I am in the Boston area, there's a few have gone under. Or some have also, you know, they're open, but they've closed tap rooms or closed outposts. And it's not clear how long they can float those closures, you know. The other parts of the business aren't going to pick up the slack. So I think you could see a reduction, you know, a significant, sizable reduction. The last big shakeout in the industry in craft beer in the U.S. was in 2000, 2001. Quite a few, I'd say like 1 in 5, 1 in 4 breweries closed. That was mostly due to the fact that a lot of imitators had jumped in the 80s and 90s. You know, the quality wasn't that great. The dedication to it wasn't that solid. They just were trying to capture this sort of hot new thing in the drinks market. But this time around, it's the fact that it's just, you know, how much beer can Americans drink or the world import? I would also add too, and I know the situation in Australia, but up here, there is quite a bit of hard seltzer flowing. People thought...
Well, actually, Tom, I was going to ask you what your next book was, and I was going to suggest the history of hard seltzer.
I find the whole... I have literally never had a hard seltzer to this. I'm old enough to remember Zima, and I'm imagining that's what they taste like, but...
You know, yeah, well, look, I've tried a few, and you're not missing much. I'll tell you that right now.
about 10 years ago, everybody thought, hard cider was going to eat into craft beer's market share. And while there was sort of a mini explosion in about 2012, 2013, it was only a few players, and it retracted very quickly. And I'm not saying, there's some fantastic hard cider up here. It's really top notch. And that in itself presents its challenges as far as production and distribution. But, that didn't knock off craft beer. But I mean, this hard seltzer stuff, I mean, it shows real staying power. And it captures kind of that, all important millennial market share, because they don't drink as much as previous generations, at least in the US. And they prefer, they go past Pilsner as far as lightness. And they go right to the clear, incredibly light, hard seltzer.
Now, you're a bit of a rare breed as a beer writer in the US, because you don't only write about beer. You also write about wine and whiskey and spirits. Are you still writing about those today?
Not as much. Not nearly as much as beer. I wrote a history of American wine called American Wine, which was a lot of fun because I learned there were a lot of parallels to the brewing industry in the US and the wine industry in the US. And they both grew up at the same time. Like a lot of consumers of wine, I assume that it had always been held in this sort of august, rarefied position. But wine was much like beer in the US. It was just sort of inexpensive, not always of the most fantastic quality, and it was homogenous. Most of it was made from a handful of grapes grape varietals that, kind of forgotten today. Most of it was in screw top bottles, giant screw top bottles, half gallons. And it didn't really take off and come into its own for a variety of reasons until the 1970s, at the same time that craft beer was kind of taking off in the US. And not only that, but, American fine wine and American craft beer basically grew up at the same time in the San Francisco area. And, a lot of the early brewers out there moved in the same circles as the early winemakers. And so it's an interesting thing, but wine kind of took off in a trajectory as far as, sort of lifestyle. Beer just, craft beer didn't have that moment for another 30 years. And that, it was very interesting to discover, because a lot of people do not realize that wine was kind of just this, plonk, and it didn't attain its rarefied air, at least in the US, but even much of Europe, until about, 1978, 1980.
Well, Tom, been a fascinating chat. Thanks so much for your time, and best of luck with the book and everything else you're working on in 2021.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.